We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. I am back, and it is so great to be back with you, our AFR family. I missed you all while I was gone on a much-needed vacation with my family, because family is incredibly important, and I really appreciate being able to take the time away from media, from ministry. But it is wonderful to be back, and I so appreciate our guest hosts, Alex McFarland and J. Christian Adams and Abraham Hamilton III, for filling in for me and getting to spend the mornings with you. But I've really missed it, and I so appreciate all of the messages and emails from listeners asking when I would be back, and saying that you missed the commentary in the mornings and the mornings that we get to spend together. So thank you all so much for that. And Todd and Copper are doing very well. Thank you all for asking about that as well. So let's get to the news. And first, you may have heard about this. We're starting with actually the most tragic story I think that I've read in quite a while, and you've probably heard by now about the young American couple that were missionaries doing missionary work that were killed by a gang in Haiti. David Lloyd, or Davy, which is actually my older brother's nickname that we've called him for a long time, so this kind of struck a chord with me because that's the name of my older brother. But Davy Lloyd and his wife Natalie, who is the daughter of Missouri State Representative Ben Baker, and a third member of their missionary group, were fatally shot in the attack. And Senator Josh Hawley has been advocating for the guarantee of their safe transfer and the remains home. And he posted this just a couple of days ago, 2 days ago, on his social media. Now Haitian gangs are threatening to stop the transport of Davy and Natalie Lloyd's bodies home to Missouri. President Biden should guarantee their safe transfer home. The government failed the Lloyds 2 days ago, and the least it can do now is to bring home their remains. So Representative Ben Baker, a father of Natalie Baker, Natalie Lloyd, joins me now. And sir, I so appreciate you coming on, and your words for your daughter have been just heart-wrenching. And I know that the bond between a father and a daughter is just so close. And the words that you've shared have just been really incredible about your daughter. And I know that you want to keep her story and her conviction for the Lord and her passion for ministry alive. So our hearts just go out to you, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Our AFR family is praying for you. And if you could just share a little bit about your daughter, her husband, and the ministry that they had.
Sure. Thank you, Jenna, for having me on. This has been the hardest thing we've ever faced in our life, but you're right in the fact that we want to tell the story of Davy and Natalie, because it brings glory to God, and it's just a perfect example of a selfless life that's so rare, especially among young people in our day and time. And I think their example of that kind of love and devotion to people, that even where obviously some of them returned that with evil, is an example of that kind of life, is what will change the world. Davy and Natalie were just exceptional young people. Natalie, from a young age, was very determined, just as sweet as can be. You would, if you met her, she's very quiet and unassuming, but don't ever mistake that for not being able to be determined and accomplish things. She was very accomplished. She was a wonderful singer and played the piano so well, and just a wonderful example. Had such a heart for God and ministry. And when she met Davey, it was just such a beautiful relationship. We loved Davey from the start. We have known their family for many years. In fact, when I was in Bible school, Davey and his sister at 5 years old were kidnapped in Haiti. And by some miracle, within, I think, 24 hours, they were returned and no harm was done. And I remember, as a young person myself, praying for the Lloyd family, praying for Davey and the return of their kids. And the Lloyds, even after that, remained in Haiti for many years and have been there for 20 some years now. And even with such a traumatic experience, continued to love the people of Haiti. And Davey, that was his life. He grew up there. He had such a heart for Haiti. And, you know, I remember many, many times talking with him and getting to know Davey as he began to, you know, this relationship began to spark between them and Bible school, and just listening to him talk about how much he loved Haiti and how much he, you know, his vision for ministry there, his long-term vision is wanted to reach more of the villages, the outer areas of Haiti with the gospel and plant churches. That was his long-term goal in Haiti. And so at the mission there, they have a Christian school. Davey's mom, Alicia, they're wonderful people. She actually developed a curriculum, K through 12, a faith-based curriculum for education in Haiti, and even some of the public schools in Haiti are using that curriculum. And they have a kids' home or orphanage, as people would view it, even though many of those kids are not technically orphans. That, you know, they have parents somewhere, but they're either, you know, not able to take care of them or don't care enough about them to take care of them. And so they had anywhere, depending on the time, 30 to 60 kids under their care there, and in the kids' home. And that was Natalie's, that was her passion. She loved the kids. And when they began to pursue this relationship, you know, we told Natalie, you need to go see Haiti. You need to visit there before this moves to marriage, because if it's something that, you know, isn't compatible in ministry, because Davey, you know, felt strongly about returning to Haiti at some point. And so we sent her over there for a couple weeks to visit with Davey and her his family. And I'll never forget when she came back, she was just beaming with big smile. And I said, well, tell me about it. You know, what did you experience and what do you think? And she said, Dad, I fell in love with Haiti. And so they pursued that and ended up getting married, and then going back shortly after they got married. They have a church there as well, as part of that mission. And it's just an amazing work, missions in Haiti. And so they're two wonderful young people with such a heart for God and heart for people.
And I'm speaking with Representative Ben Baker, Natalie's father, and thank you so much for sharing the story of Natalie and Davey's passion to live for Christ and to literally give their lives in service of the gospel. And if more people were willing to do that, we would have a complete transformation, I believe, of the world and the spreading of the gospel. And they are two beautiful examples of what it means to live for Christ, but to die is gain. And we know that we will see them again in heaven. And so, Representative Baker, what is the current status of what you would like to share with the AFR family of how we can not only pray for you, for your family, for your wife, for Davy's family, and also the political situation with trying to bring Davy and Natalie home.
Sure. So as you can imagine, with the chaos in Haiti, how difficult it is to do anything. And, you know, there is protocol when it comes to paperwork and getting them home, you know, is our biggest priority right now, so that we can have services and have closure. And so the paperwork, they're working on it. I think there's one more document, hopefully today, that can be signed off on by, I believe it's the Minister of Health. And once those documents are finished, they are currently at a hospital near the embassy. Their bodies are there, and a mortuary service will come to the hospital, I believe, and prepare them for transit. Once that is done, they can be flown home. We do have an airline that has agreed to do that, which was a major part of the hurdles in this process, just finding an airline that would do that. And so if everything goes smoothly, I think it's very possible that we get them back home this week. So, you know, security is an issue. There's just a lot of things involved with that process. You know, it's just it's an anxiety that we're feeling right now, a roller coaster of emotions and grief and also just, you know, trying to work through this process of getting them home. And so that's, you know, several things that people can pray for, that process continues to go smoothly and everything goes well to get them home.
And we will be praying for that. And how are you and your wife dealing with this kind of grief in the midst of your faith? I know that there are so many people that are listening that have also lost children or lost loved ones. And how are you beginning to process this?
It's something that I've never experienced before. You know, I've taught about grief from a book learning perspective, but I've never dealt with it to this kind of level. And it's just a moment by moment process of, you know, it's a mixture of so many raw emotions and, but the strength that we have felt has been remarkable. And I know it's the prayers of people all around the world right now that are praying for our families. I don't see how in the world I could do it otherwise. But I think it's a mixture of, you know, even though I don't understand, God's plan in this, I know he does have a plan, and I'm trying to trust that. I believe in the sovereignty of God, and I believe that his plans are greater than ours, though we don't understand it. And I can already see where God is using this in powerful ways to reach millions of people. I've had many, many messages and calls and hearing stories from people around the world that this has touched their lives in such a deep way already. I think it's a modern day example of a Jim Elliot type situation that this generation has never seen face to face, really, especially young people like they are. And, you know, I believe that God's going to use this in a mighty way. I believe that it could be the spark of a new generation of young people that are inspired and dedicated to do missions work. If that's what God's plan is, then I'm willing to try to follow that and to trust that and believe in it, even though it's so painful in this process. And there's just so many other things as well. You know, the family of Jude, who is the Haitian national, the other young man that died, they're desperately needing prayer. The young man that found Davy and Natalie and Jude is really struggling, just the things that he witnessed. And feeling guilty that he didn't do enough or couldn't get there in time and all those things. So pray for them. There's just so many things involved with it, but we know that people are praying.
Well, we are praying as an AFR family. We can promise you that. And thank you for telling their story and for trusting the Lord's sovereignty. And we will continue to pray for peace that passes all understanding, that in the midst of this tragedy, that God would raise up another generation of missionaries to continue the work of Davy and Natalie. So thank you, Representative Baker. We'll be right back with more here on AFR. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And wow, I am so grateful for Representative Baker and coming on to talk about his daughter. And it's still just, I know you all probably are now wishing that you had the other guest host, because this has been an emotional morning. But, you know, it really did, that story really did remind me of Jim Elliot and Elizabeth Elliot and their whole story when I first read the story of Davy and Natalie Lloyd. And it's such a poignant reminder that we need to live for the Lord, and no matter what comes, even if you go through the midst of the worst tragedy possible, that God's sovereignty does persist, and that we can trust the Lord through all circumstances. I cannot imagine how hard it must be for their families right now, but knowing that their calling was of Davy and Natalie Lloyd was to be in Haiti and in service to the Lord and to continue to be missionaries, it is a conviction, I think, for all of us to ask ourselves the question, what does God have for us to do? And are we willing to give our lives and you know, maybe not everyone is called to be a missionary to a foreign country, but we are called to serve the Lord in the ways that He has called us individually, and to give our lives in service to the Lord where He has placed us, and to give up ourselves. That's what it means to become a Christian, is to daily be transformed to the image of Christ and to give up ourselves and our desires and our pursuits and all of the things that are so meaningless. Because at the end of the day, all that matters is that we love the Lord and that we share the truth of the gospel with others. And I was on social media yesterday and was actually listening to this clip, and we have it from Russell Brand, who you may know as, you know, kind of one of these very vitriolic actors. And and actually our next guest is ready, so we're gonna play the Russell Brand. Oh, I'm sorry. The clip is ready. Thank you, Devin. So the clip is ready for Russell Brand. We are waiting on Joel Rosenberg, by the way, who will be our next guest. But Russell Brand was sharing about his faith. So we'll play that clip now on being a Christian for 1 month and how his whole life and perspective has been transformed. And listening to this, it was just really incredible, because obviously he's a very, very new Christian. But he gets it. He gets it on the conviction of the Holy Spirit and living every moment in the transformation of the truth of the gospel. So this is what he posted on X yesterday.
I've been a Christian a month now, and it's been a big change. Not that I've entirely changed as a person, of course I haven't, but I've taken on a lot of new concepts, and it changes you to accept that it's not like you're in a game show and by doing really, really good things you can get redeemed. No, repentance, to repent, means that you have to continually change and acknowledge that I am in a battle against myself, that I need to surrender myself to an ever-present, internal and accessible Jesus, that mercy is something that's given to me, been granted to me, that I live with through love, not something that I can sort of win or achieve by doing good deeds. It's brought incredible people to me, incredible literature to me. It's brought a sense of peace. And when I'm in doubt, I feel that instruction is there, accessible. I feel like I know what I'm supposed to do. And when I don't do what I'm supposed to do, that's even clearer. When I feel myself being selfish or inconsiderate or putting myself first or not thinking about how I can be better to other people, it's as if there is an inner illumination available to me now. I love the simplicity of the idea of God come to earth as a man to experience what it is to be human and to sacrifice himself, because that's the only sacrifice that could bring us home, that could give us the opportunity for redemption. I like the idea when I'm in prayer and in communion, just alone, that there is a figure available, wounded and coronated, available to me. In my failings and my failures and in my fallibility, there is strength to be broken, not just broken by life in the sense of life is wearying and exhausting, but to be broken in the same way that you have to train an animal to behave itself, to be broken into better conduct. It's a beautiful journey to go on. I know I'm just at the beginning. I know I'm just learning. I know there's so much more to learn, and I'm so excited to learn more from you and for us to learn together. Let me know where your journey's taking you. Can you remember your first month as a Christian? And let me know if, since I've been talking about this publicly, it's made you think about Christianity differently. We're having lots of conversations about this stuff, and I'm so grateful to be having them with you. Stay free.
That was Russell Brand, who goes by at Rusty Rockets on X. And this clip to me was so encouraging, because it is a great reminder that God is still in the business of saving souls and of changing hearts and minds. And if he can reach someone like Russell Brand, and if any of you know, his entire career, then that means that he can reach me and you too, and he can reach anyone, and we can also be a conduit to the gospel and be used of the Lord to reach more and more people. And even though we talk about the news of the day headlines, and I do want to get to a few of those this morning, because there is a lot going on in our civil society, we always have to remember that the greatest commission that we have as Christians is to promote the truth of the gospel and to live for Christ, to know him and to worship him fully. That is our number one objective as human beings, is to understand who God is and to come into a right relationship with him and then share that truth with others. And it's so encouraging to hear testimonies like that and to hear him saying that he wants to have more conversations, and he knows that he's a very young Christian, but that kind of excitement and enthusiasm, if you've ever been around, or if you've been a new Christian, or you've been around a new Christian that is just so excited and so hungry to learn more, that should be us. I mean, and that's when the psalmist says, Lord, give me renew the joy of my salvation. When you just cannot sleep, you want to just eat and drink and breathe the knowledge of the Lord. And we need to never get so bogged down with the things of this world and the trials and tribulations and the frustrations and everything that we contend with, that we forget to contend for the gospel. And so why is it that we talk about various points of doctrine, or we talk about other truths on this show and on so many others on AFR. It comes down to the fact that not only are we wanting first and foremost to share the truth of the gospel of Christ with those who are not yet Christians, but then for those of us, which is most hopefully all of the AFR family, we want to continue to contend for the gospel. We can't just sit back and say, oh, this is too divisive, or this topic, you know, we don't want to get into these areas. We don't want to offend, or, you know, this is an in-house debate, as they say, and this is, you know, something that ultimately isn't a salvation issue. So, you know, maybe we're not going to talk about, you know, some of these differences because, hey, we're all Christians. Well, yeah, there are some in-house debates, and there are some things like eschatology, for example, the end of all things, that's a big one, that really is an in-house debate. But that doesn't mean that we don't talk about it. It doesn't mean that we don't contend for the gospel, that we don't continue to rightly divide truth from error. Because if we are going to continue to work out our salvation and to continue in the joy of our salvation, and if we are going to continue living as Davy and Natalie Lloyd did, with putting their all to help young children and others to come into a saving knowledge of the Lord, then we have to have that knowledge to begin with. And we have to know, as 1 Peter 3:15 says, we have to be able to give an answer for the hope that lies within us. And it's not just about having passion for the Lord. Anyone can have passion for even something that's false. I mean, you have a lot of people in other religions that are just as passionate, maybe even more passionate, unfortunately, than Christians are. You can be passionate about the wrong thing. Passion is not what it's about. Yes, we should express emotion that flows from truth, but it has to be centered and fixed and rooted and grounded in a knowledge of the truth. And we have to live a life that is worthy of the gospel. And as Philippians 1 says, this is 1:27, whatever happens, literally whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come or see you or only hear about you in my absence, and this is, of course, Paul talking to the church at Philippi, I know that you stand firm in the one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, now I hear that you have. And of course, he's talking, like I said, to the Philippian church, but knowing that we stand firm as one for the faith of the gospel. There are so many issues that divide us, especially right now in today's political climate and policy and tribalism and so many other things. And yes, we can and should debate those things. And it's actually okay that we have different opinions on various, you know, policy differences, on politicians that we support or don't, or, you know, or other things. And hopefully your opinions are grounded in truth, and your Christian faith then guides you and is the light unto your path, so that we can have the best decisions in all other areas of how we live out our faith in all of the other spheres of government, which include the civil government, the church government, and the family government. But we should, as one Christian body, be firmly centered on the faith of the gospel. And we have to first rightly divide truth from error and know what the gospel says, know who God is, and call out false doctrine wherever it persists. And in talking to some people, even over the break, I was talking to a friend of mine about, you know, just various books we're reading and some of those other things. And she remarked to me that, you know, often women tend to be more critical of other women in ministry. And I said, actually, you know, I think that that's true because it tends to be, at least in my observation, it tends to be that women in particular, when they go outside the authority of the church structure, which God in his word says should be led by men, the ecclesia, and the pastors and the church leaders are that those roles belong to men, and not just any men, but to men who fit the qualifications of church officers. And that certainly is not every man. When women go outside of that and do not, and when anyone, I mean, it's men and women can go outside of church authority. And that goes back to original sin where we went outside of God's created order and his own authority, and we wanted to be like God. But when we go outside of God's created order, his delegated authority in any sphere of government, but particularly the church, that's when we can most easily get off. And a lot of women, especially women who want to hold the role of pastor in the church or even co-pastor or take upon themselves an office of the church that is outside of God's authority, you are just asking to be off further and to not stand firm on what the Bible teaches. Because it's not my opinion or your opinion or a wisdom issue. It's about simply reading what God has to say and actually following it. And there was a quotation, and I think it was from Chesterton. It might have been someone else, and Devin will probably Google this and correct me. But it's, you know, the Christian life has not been tried and found wanting. It has been tried and found difficult. That is absolutely true. Because it is not that the way of God is so impossible. It's that it goes against everything that our passions in our sin and our human flesh want. And so the very first thing of the Christian is to stand firm for one faith, stand firm in the one Spirit. And then we don't have to be frightened in any way by anyone who opposes us. I have learned through so much opposition across the entire spectrum of a lot of things that my confidence is not because I'm so much more, you know, I've grown into loving myself and being so much more confident in who I am and all of these affirmations of the wisdom of the world. It's that as I've gotten older, I have become so much more confident in who God is. And because of who God is, I know that my identity is solely 100% in Christ alone. And when I simply follow him and teach his truth, then it doesn't matter who opposes me. I mean, fine, you can have your opinion, but take it up with God, because it's not my opinion, it's God's. And that's my favorite thing to say to people who oppose me is, well, you know, sorry, if you don't like it, take it up with God. And I promise he will have an answer for you. So we need to boldly live as Christ, and then we can boldly go into our civil society. And we can stand for truth no matter who opposes us, no matter, even if sometimes we get it wrong, we can then say, yeah, I got it wrong because I'm not perfect, but thankfully I have a God who is. And we can strive always to promote the truth of the gospel. We'll be right back with more.
I believe the left is, most of the people on the left either are sympathetic with the pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas protesters, or they're afraid of them.
Yeah.
That's why they don't change the policies. They should be saying, if you're protesting on a college campus with something over your face, you'll be arrested. All right? My rant's over.
Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
All right, that quote was by G.K. Chesterton, so I got that right, but I did not quite get the exact quote correct. This is from G.K. Chesterton's What's Wrong with the World, and it says, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." So that is a quote by Chesterton, and I think is very apt and is one of my favorites. All right, so let's get into some of the news. Our good friend Joel Rosenberg was supposed to join us this morning, and obviously we have not been able to get a hold of him. Hopefully everything is okay there in Jerusalem. He actually sent me a piece this morning that he wanted to talk about, and so we'll try to, if he doesn't come on in this last segment, we'll try to get him rescheduled for tomorrow or later this week. But the piece that he sent me was from allisrael.com, and he tweeted this, or X, whatever you want to call it now. After endorsing Trump, Nikki Haley comes straight to Israel. Is she auditioning to be Trump's Secretary of State? I asked Haley about her relationship with the presumptive GOP nominee. So very interesting that former UN ambassador Nikki Haley is now traveling to Israel. There's been a lot of speculation about her potential role in a second Trump administration. Joel writes in this article that he thinks that she has been ruled out as a VP candidate. There's still a lot of speculation. My personal opinion, just having obviously worked for Donald Trump, knowing how he considers these things, I don't think anything or anyone is off the table until he actually announces his VP pick. So whether that's Haley or someone else, who knows? Even if he thinks he's decided at this point, something could happen tonight or tomorrow that will change his decision, inform his decision. So we will not know who the VP pick is until he actually announces it. So I think Haley and probably dozens of other people are still in the mix. But could she be a pick for Secretary of State? That's possible. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has indicated that he would take his old job back. So there's, you know, again, this is a lot of people that are vying for different positions in a potential next Trump administration. But it's interesting to see that Nikki Haley is still making headlines after getting out of the primary, unlike someone like Governor DeSantis, who has solely focused on Florida. I think out of anyone, he probably is not the VP pick, only because he doesn't appear to be vying for it. And I don't personally think, also just knowing him and the whole, you know, situation, that he would step away from 2 more years of being Florida's governor and having a really good run toward 2028 to become the vice president on a ticket that, you know, right now is very close. And there are reports even this morning from Politico Playbook that a lot of the Biden campaign consultants are very concerned that Biden is the candidate, and they're not really as confident in his candidacy. And, you know, whether that's accurate or they're just playing to the media, well, good. I certainly do not think that Biden should have another 4 years to foist on America the truly unconstitutional and just ridiculously un-American policies that he has. And I mean, I'm sort of in the camp anyone but Biden, and certainly for the things that all of you know that I think Trump could do better, he is certainly better at the end of the day, particularly on judges, a lot of other things, than Biden. So that also comes in the wake of another headline on Israel, and this coming from Reuters. Israeli attack on Rafah tent camp kills 45, prompts international outcry. So an Israeli airstrike triggered a fire that killed 45 people in a tent camp in the Gazan city of Rafah, officials said yesterday, prompting an outcry from global leaders who urged the implementation of a world court order to halt Israel's assault. The UN's chief court, the ICJ, has now said that, and the chief judge has told Israel now to halt their assault, and whether or not they actually have jurisdiction to do that is a question. But certainly these are really bad optics for Israel. And we, of course, as Christians, are very pro-Israel from a biblical standpoint. That doesn't mean that the Israeli government, whatever they do, is justified. Just like I'm very pro-America as an American, but that doesn't necessarily mean that every action that our military could possibly take, even when engaged in some kind of conflict, would necessarily be justified according to ethics, just war theory, rules of engagement, all of those things. So we need to separate that difference where we can be pro-Israel, but still critique and analyze whether the actions that Israel's government are taking are sound, whether we agree with them. But the world court order that is telling Israel to halt its assault, I think is improper and should just be disregarded. But this is really bad optics for Israel because even Netanyahu is calling this a terrible mistake. And we have one clip that's kind of a voiceover that came from ABC News. So this is a Brit Clinette on the Rafah tragic mishap. This is cut two.
Tonight, screams of horror amid a burning inferno. The frightful, frantic moments after Israeli strikes engulfed a refugee camp in western Rafah on Sunday night. Desperate attempts to put out the flames, people scrambling to rescue anyone they can. At least 50 killed and 249 injured in the overnight attack, according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. Many people treated with severe burns and shrapnel injuries. Tonight, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calling the strikes a tragic mishap, saying there was a technical failure and that the incident will be investigated. The strikes hitting the Tal al-Sultan area. Manal Salman saying, "We were in the tents and suddenly we found rockets falling on us in the same place. There is nowhere safe for us to go." Her family now forced to move for the eighth time. The IDF claiming they were conducting an intelligence-based strike, which killed two senior Hamas officials, stating they regret any harm to uninvolved civilians during combat. The White House speaking out, a National Security Council spokesperson calling the images out of Rafah devastating and heartbreaking, adding that Israel must protect civilians, though maintaining the White House position that Israel has a right to go after Hamas.
So that was ABC News. And interestingly, the White House is maintaining that position, which is a good thing overall for Israel. But we'll continue to follow that story and hopefully get our good friend Joel Rosenberg on to comment about that, the Nikki Haley situation, and so much more. And you can always read what is going on from a Christian and also Israel national citizen perspective, Joel Rosenberg, at allisrael.com, allisrael.com. So turning now to, of course, the other stories that are kind of big today, which is that the Trump trial in Manhattan, the hush money case, the end is near, is what Politico Playbook is saying today, because closing arguments will begin this morning. There was a week break for the jury. And then, of course, yesterday with the Memorial Day observation, I don't really like to call it a holiday per se, but, you know, it's certainly a time to remember those who have given their all in service to our country. And we're so thankful for those who give the last full measure of their devotion to keep our country free, because freedom is not free. So as we now enter into the week with this Tuesday, closing arguments will begin in Trump's Manhattan hush money case and could continue into tomorrow. And so the way that this works, now that all of the evidence has been entered into the record, which include, you know, the documents, testimony, all of that over the last 5 weeks, now closing arguments will happen. And Trump posted on his Truth Social that, you know, he's very upset that the prosecution gets to go last, which that's pretty standard. And, you know, I'm not as familiar with the specifics of local practice, and that, of course, varies depending on the jurisdiction. But at least in Colorado, where I'm licensed and, you know, practiced in court for a long time when I was still living there before, you know, I went to D.C., worked for Trump, and now I live in Florida. But when I was still in court and actually in trial, both as a prosecutor, then a defense attorney, I had some other civil cases. In criminal law, the prosecutor goes first, then because they have to prove their case. And the whole point of that is to say, okay, prosecutors, now that all of the evidence is entered, give it your best shot. You are the ones that have to fulfill the burden of proof, the burden of production, and prove each and every element of each and every charge beyond any and all reasonable doubt. It's a very high threshold, even though in the court of public opinion, it seems like it's a, well, do we more or less think that, you know, this guy is guilty or not? That is not how a jury should ever approach any case, whether it's high profile or whether it's, you know, the lowest of the low misdemeanor that goes to trial. A jury should always understand that the prosecutor has a very, very high standard, the highest standard, in fact, in all of law, is the criminal law standard. And that's for a purpose, because we know, and our founders knew, that that standard can be abused, and that criminal courts by prosecutors that work on behalf of the state or the government can abuse that, and that liberty is on the line. And so so that's always something that the jury should keep in mind. But the prosecutor goes first for that reason. Then the defense gets to make their argument. And then, generally speaking, the prosecution then gets a short rebuttal to the defense's argument. Then the trial's still not done. Then the judge has to give jury instructions. And these jury instructions in Trump's case have been litigated ad nauseum. And this is what Alan Dershowitz had to say about it. This is cut four.
And if the past is prologue, you can expect an extremely unfair instruction, biased in favor of the prosecution and against the defense. And so, even though this is the weakest case in my 60 years of experience, having done hundreds of cases, perhaps more than any lawyer, living lawyer, maybe any lawyer in American history, private lawyer, I've done more criminal cases, taught them, wrote about them, litigated them, argued them on television. I have a whole series called Great Trials, where I write introductions to over 100 of them. It's something I really know pretty well. There has never in my experience been a weaker case than this one. Never. I've never seen a weaker case.
That was Alan Dershowitz, a former Harvard law professor and a friend of the show, commenting on that. And I agree with them. I mean, this was by far, out of, you know, all of the indictments of Donald Trump, this was by far the weakest, but it was the one that got to go to trial before the November election. And it's as simple as that. I mean, this was the first indictment to be handed down back last August, first to go to trial, and now will first come to a conclusion. So what are the potential outcomes? Well, there can be several. There could be a full guilty on all 34 counts. There could be a full not guilty on all 34 counts. Or there could be kind of a mixed bill, which in defense parlance, we call splitting the baby. I actually really hate that term, but it goes back to, of course, the incident with Solomon, with the two women who came and were asking for his adjudication of their issue, basically. And he said, you know, with whose child is this? And he said in his wisdom, okay, well, we will literally cut the baby in half and give one half to each of the women. And the real mother said, no, I would rather give him up than see him sacrificed. And that's how he knew in his wisdom. But in a not so wise way, we tend to use that as the split or mixed bag verdict, which is, according to a lot of defense attorneys, unwise, because it gives the jury a way to kind of make all sides happy, and is not really just in a lot of circumstances, generally according to defense lawyers, because prosecutors are fine of course they would like to get guilty on all counts, but especially Alvin Bragg right now and the prosecution, they really want a conviction on even one single count. Why? Because then it goes to sentencing, and then Joe Biden can campaign, and the Democrats can campaign on the fact that Trump is now a convicted felon and Trump in jail time. If the jury does convict on even one of the 34 counts, which I think is likely, unfortunately, and yes, it'll be wrapped up in appeals and all this stuff, but for probably the duration of the campaign, not only will Trump be called a convicted felon, but one question will then be, could Trump go to jail? And according to CBS News, the Secret Service is preparing for that possibility, or even home confinement, or even if Trump is let out on, you know, some kind of quote unquote probation, that still gives the district court in New York a lot of power over Trump, and will he have to ask permission to leave the state? Will he have to, you know, if he transfers his probation to Florida, then will he have to ask permission to leave the state to go campaign? I mean, this could really seriously complicate campaigning for him. So there are a lot of questions that are not yet answered, and we will see about that. I'm going to have a Legal Eagle panel this evening on my Salem Media Show. You can watch that at Watch Salem News or SalemNewsChannel.com at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight, and we're going to delve into this a little bit more. But you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net, and it is so great to be back with you. I will see you tomorrow. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.